This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We're going to talk about hate today, and hate is a peculiar thing. I mean, just think about the many ways we use the word. For instance, I hate to shop for clothes. Once a year, my lovely wife tricks me into getting into the car, then drives me to a department store and makes me buy new clothes. Hate it. So there, that's one way to use the word. But even though we use the word casually, like I just did, hate can obviously have dangerous implications. What does it really mean to hate? And why do we do it? Especially when it eats us up inside, when we unleash all of these harmful behaviors for ourselves and others, it leads to violence. Why do we do it? Where does it come from? Why can't we get rid of it? On today's show, we'll examine hate and human nature and take your phone calls. How do you express your hatred or something or someone you hate? What do you think about it? How do you rid yourself of hateful emotions? 877-962-9862 is the number to call. SOT@WUNC.org is the email address. First, I want to talk to Lasana Harris. He is an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. Lasana, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you.
Thank you. Good to have me back.
Good to be had here. Well, I'm glad you're liking it, because if you hated the whole experience, we'd have to stop now. What's happening to our brains and our bodies? What in our brains, what's happening when we hate? Do we know?
Well, hate tends to be one of the most understudied emotions. I think because to study hate, you have to exhibit hateful behaviors in participants, and ethically, that's very difficult to do. So review boards hardly let us study hate in sort of an ecologically valid way. That being said, we've studied a lot of processes related to hate. So, for instance, group phenomena, inner group phenomena. We have a lot of research that tells us about what parts of the brain are involved, what networks, what chemicals. And so we know quite a bit about inner group phenomena arising out of inner group competition that often can lead to hate. So, for instance, there's a part of the brain that's pretty famous by now, the amygdala, that serves as sort of a vigilance detector in the brain. Essentially, when you have a strong emotional reaction to something, when there's an emotionally relevant stimulus in your environment, your amygdala gets going, and that part of the brain is widely interconnected. It is basically the central station in your brain where everything routes through, and that can direct a set of behavioral responses as well as other emotions. So in intergroup context, what we find is that human beings are wired such that their amygdalas get going when they see outgroup members, people that don't belong to their in-group. And that vigilant system can either lead to hateful and negative behaviors, but it can also lead to affiliative behaviors as well. So we're beginning to unravel some of the neuroscience behind processes that feed into hate, but there's still a lot that we're unclear about.
I mean, that leads to the question about whether you can even define hate in terms of the behavior or in terms of the things that light up in your head. Do we know, you know, I mean, it's that sort of thing. Am I acting hatefully, or is there something going on that that produces this thing called hate?
Yeah, recently we've started to explore some more casual forms of hate. So for instance, think about the Yankees and the Red Sox. Those fans hate each other, in quotation marks. And so there's beginning to be some studies that have looked at rivalries in sports, for instance, where loyal fan bases claim to hate the other base. And what you find in those studies is essentially lots of Schadenfreude effects, right, that go along with hatred.
What's so that kind of effect?
Schadenfreude is sort of having joy at seeing somebody else's suffering. So when, for instance, the star pitcher gets hit or the Red Sox just traded away three or four of their main players, there are lots of New York Yankee fans who are feeling joy at that. Right. And so that Schadenfreude comes from a place of hate. Right. It's because of this inner group competition. And it's interesting to look at scientifically because the brain mechanisms that mediate emotional learning and emotional responding seem to be involved. But again, there's lots more research that's needed before we can pinpoint specific mechanisms and networks.
And are they separate mechanisms when we talk about these interpersonal or intergroup kinds of behaviors and feelings than when it comes to me in clothes shopping, for instance, just avoiding uncomfortable circumstances?
No, they're not very different mechanisms. I think if you're thinking about human beings and how we're built, the reason perhaps why we evolved the way we did is because of our group behavior. What's interesting about thinking about groups is that groups allow us to do things that we couldn't have done otherwise. So we were able to form tight-knit groups around some type of common goal or unifying symbol. But with that groupiness came outgroups and came people who were threatening those goals that we might have as a group. And so the mechanisms that evolve to allow us to cooperate, to be pro-social and altruistic, tend to be the mechanisms that can get perverted in intergroup competition contexts, where now they're the same mechanisms that are motivating your behavior that might be hateful or negative. So you look at, again, this brain structure, the amygdala, it's involved in positive things as well as negative things, but the context is what matters.
And so that leads to the question about whether or not hate is something common to all social animals, or is it uniquely human?
I think it's uniquely human in the way it's expressed, but if you look at correlates of hateful behavior, so let's take murder, for instance, right? Intergroup violence can lead to murder. Human beings are capable of very wonderful pro-social things and very horrible things in intergroup contexts. Not every species engages in that behavior. And interestingly, brain size and development doesn't matter. So in mice, for instance, you find cases where they will murder each other. But in their close cousins, rats, you don't see that behavior. If they're involved in a conflict, one member of that species will display some submissive behavior when they're being defeated, and that will be the end of it. They won't take it that extra step.
So mice, so Jimmy Cagney should have said, you dirty mouse, not you dirty
exactly.
Rat.
Exactly. Rats get a bad name.
What other animals murder?
You see similar things in canines, for instance. So wolves will murder when they're sort of prowling, right? So you have a pack of wolves and they're out prowling. They meet some unfamiliar wolf and that poor guy is in trouble. But dogs won't do that, right? Dogs are a very close cousin of wolves. They won't engage in that type of murderous behavior. You also see it, for instance, in chimpanzees. Chimpanzees are pretty nasty animals. And again, they will murder each other if they encounter them in this intergroup context. But their close cousins, bonobos, won't engage in that behavior. And so this kind of evidence suggests that it's not an issue of brain size or development. It's not something that's uniquely human in that sense. But in human beings, we have the ability to do both. We have the ability to act like the rats, the dogs, and the bonobos. And we also have the ability to be sort of more aggressive in our behaviors as well.
Well, it does suggest that that the environment or social context would play a part. So, well, let's take the chimps and the bonobos, for instance.
Right.
Anybody want to speculate on why the bonobos would rather make love?
Definitely. So if you look at where they're found in Africa, they're found right around the Congo River. And so north of the Congo River, you tend to find chimpanzees. South of the river, you find bonobos. Well, what's different in those two environments? North of the river, you get other primates as well. So you get orangutans, you get gorillas. And so there's lots of competition for food. South of the river, you don't have any other primates there besides human beings, of course. And so bonobos face very little competition for food. That kind of an environment, the competitive one, could potentially be what's responsible for these sort of hateful behaviors, these negative behaviors. Whereas when you have a lack of competition, perhaps that allows these creatures to evolve in a manner where intergroup conflicts aren't as necessary, because there's not a sort of limited resource that you're competing over.
So anything that promotes competition or somehow suggests or infuses the notion of scarcity, we can expect perhaps more.
Exactly. Scarcity over resources and then competing over the same goal, for instance, in the sports team example, right? You all want to win that pennant or whatever it is that you're going after. Yeah. And so competition is one thing in human beings that breeds hate, and in other species as well. And so that's sort of what we think of as the roots of hate.
How do you study this in humans, and is it easier to do in animals?
It's not easy to do in any species. In humans, it's difficult for ethical reasons. We can't bring people into our labs and have them engage in hateful behaviors. But we can measure aggressive behaviors, and we are beginning to find creative ways to do so. So, for instance, there are a couple of social psychological studies where essentially you have two people that are interacting. One is a fake participant who pisses the real participant off, gets him angry. And then you give the real participant the opportunity to put hot sauce in the fake participant's food. And you measure the amount of hot sauce they put as sort of a passive-aggressive way of expressing their anger. There are also ways that involve blasting the other person with white noise, for instance, which isn't going to damage them. But again, it's a passive-aggressive way. And so we've begun studying it in these kinds of narrow contexts. Again, it's very difficult for us to get real-life hateful examples because of the ethical reasons. But we're moving slowly towards studying these processes.
Have you looked at what happens to a brain on hate, what other kind of changes take place, and whether there are any sort of long-lasting, enduring changes that may occur to the brain?
The long-lasting question is a very good one. I think to this point, researchers haven't started to study these long-term changes in these social contexts, but that's something that I believe is quickly changing. And so within the next 5 or 10 years, I think there will be research suggesting what happens to the brain, for instance, with prolonged exposure towards hateful stimuli or in contexts where you're constantly in a state of hate. But at this point, we have very little information about that.
Neurologically, can you distinguish hate from anger? Do they look the same?
Neurologically, we haven't been able to put hate in an fMRI machine, but we think theoretically that it's related to anger, and so we don't expect it to look very different. There's another interesting emotion here that we've been ignoring, and that's disgust. It turns out that disgust is actually responsible for a lot more of the negative behaviors than anger or hate. Hate and anger are strong emotions, and they're mainly attitudinal. They rarely drive behavior in the way that disgust does, because disgust says this thing, this contaminant is dangerous and threatening, and I need to stamp it out. And so there are studies that show, for instance, that hate correlates to more sort of rule-observing behaviors, so things like sit-ins and protests. If I'm feeling lots of hate and lots of anger, I'm more likely to go protest. If I'm feeling disgust, I'm more likely to engage in rule-violating behaviors. I'm more likely to do things like break shop windows and do things that violate common rules and norms. And so hate, it seems, is much more of an attitudinal response that's useful for the in-group. It's something that allows us to rally around each other to say, yes, we hate those Red Sox fans. Yes, we don't like them. And that attitude drives us towards being a better in-group.
On the State of Things today, we are talking about hate. We're inviting your phone calls, and you're listening to the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're talking about hatred and human nature. My guest, Lasana Harris, assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke. Joining us now is Michael Waltman. He's an associate professor in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Good to have you here. Joseph Kennedy is with us as well, professor of law at UNC, and he is in our studio. Welcome, Joe.
Good to be with you.
So now we've been talking about the idea of the biology behind hate. Michael, let's talk about the way we express this and articulate that emotion. You're an expert in hate speech. Can you define that term for us, hate speech?
Well, if we sort of begin with a definition of hate as kind of an extreme dislike of someone because specifically of their ethnicity, their race, their religion, gender, or sexual orientation, then hate speech is going to be a means by which we denigrate those kinds of identities.
And what is the value of it? Do we know what, I mean, how effective is it? Does it just sort of stir up your side, or, you know, how, what effect does it have?
Persuasively, hatred can be used in a variety of ways. Hate groups might use hate speech to recruit people, to recruit children, to recruit adults, to socialize them, to provide them with the right kinds of beliefs in order to be the right kind of white person or the right kind of neo-Nazi or the right kind of skinhead.
So how do you study this? You start with this definition, and then you begin to examine texts, right, and analyze them.
Right. From my own perspective, what I've done is to look at a variety of different kinds of texts, racist novels written by the idea people within the hate movement, web pages maintained by hate groups and newsletters and newspapers specifically oriented towards producing hate.
So, Joe, you've researched the motivations behind hate crimes. How do those crimes – what's the difference, again, between hate and outrage? And how, and can we distinguish what is a hate crime from a simple crime?
Well, you know, legally, there's various definitions that have taken various forms that have tried to get a handle on it with differing – levels of success. I mean, it's a mental state question, which is often difficult to determine, and it can sometimes in a particular case turn on whether, for example, a racial epithet might have been uttered during an assault, right? The larger question, I think, is that we think of hate, we associate hate with extreme acts of violence. I mean, recently there have been a number of them in the news, sort of people going on shooting rampages. And this is – it's interesting because we think about hate as a very pure sort of emotion. So it's not surprising that we associate it with very extreme acts of violence. I mean, people talk about being consumed by hatred. I mean, you know, on the sports rivalry point, there's that book, you know, to hate like this is to be happy forever. It's almost an idea that people are energized, motivated, fueled by hatred. But when you actually look at the sort of offenders who go on these sort of rampages, they're really sort of pathetic figures. And when you think about it, how empty does your life have to be for you to, you know, strap on your gear, load up your guns, leave your house, and know you're never coming back? Also, you can engage in this extreme act of violence where you, you know, kill a number of people, and usually end up either dying yourself or spending the rest of your life in prison. That person isn't full of anything. They're empty. They're completely alienated. There's not a person, not a relationship, not a pet, not a meal in their life that they would that would keep them from giving it all up just to sort of give away to this strong feeling, which we call hate.
I wonder if you've done any work on that, Lasana, the idea of people who are in a strong relationship or feel strongly related, even if it's to their group, versus those who somehow feel isolated, if that brain looks any different, if they're any more susceptible to being moved into one camp or another.
Yeah, the isolation point is very interesting. We have a fundamental need as human beings to belong to groups. And if we do experiments where we reject people from groups, even simple rejections, where let's say the three people are tossing a ball to each other and suddenly you get left out, two people keep tossing it between themselves, that triggers really strong emotions. But it also activates parts of the brain that also get activated for pain. And so we think about physical pain and social pain that can come from rejection and isolation is very similar. Now, people in that mood state aren't necessarily likely to pick up a gun and sort of do hateful things. If you look at how that emotion evolves, there's an initial angry response, an initial anger response that quickly sort of leads into depression. And so isolation itself mightn't be necessary unless the person keeps sort of feeding back into that loop. And so you keep reminding yourself of the rejection, so you keep triggering that anger. Now you have sort of the motivation to do it. But if it stays there long enough, you start self-reflecting, and at least most normal people would get depressed instead of continue to be angry. And so as you pointed out, people that do these hate crimes, they are damaged people. They are people that aren't normal functioning like you or I, for instance. They probably have some other psychological disorder that's driving them to that response.
And in that emptiness and isolation, that's when texts that sort of bolster an identity can allow, I suppose, the individual to take on the identity that's been lost through this rejection.
And I think, you know, it's the notion of that emptiness that points to something else about hate. I mean, we really do associate hatred very often with a kind of white-hot rage that results in horrendous acts of violence, and that's certainly there. But one of the things that happens along the way is that sometimes that white-hot rage turns to indifference, right? So that an individual could just literally have no feeling, no empathy for another, so that if they did cease to exist, the person would really feel nothing at all.
Which is the thing that keeps most of us from killing each other when
exactly.
we get angry, is
exactly.
some sense of connection and empathy. What would this feel like to me? Let's go to the phones. Joshua is in Four Oaks and has a question for us. Hello, Joshua.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
This is great. First time I've ever made a phone call like this.
Welcome aboard, Josh.
Okay, so I was wondering, one of two things. Does this hateful behavior, aggression, does it look neurologically different from anxiety in the basal lateral amygdala or the dorsal medial prefrontal cortex?
This is why you've never been on before, Joshua, because you said words we don't understand. But I know Lasana's going to handle it and break it down. Great question. Thank you, Joshua.
Yeah, so it's context dependent. So it depends on the particular paradigm we came up with. That drives the specific activation pattern. So yes, the amygdala is involved. With fMRI, it's hard for us to tell which subnuclei of the amygdala. We don't have the resolution to see it, so it might be basolateral, it could be central nucleus. But the amygdala does get involved, and so those things aren't distinguished as far as we can tell.
Well, would it make – I don't know what those two things are and why it would make a difference, but what would be the difference and why would those two structures matter, whether one was engaged with
right.
the other?
Right. So the amygdala is not one structure. It's a complex of structures, and depending on the specific nuclei of that complex, it's involved in very different things, for instance. And so – in humans, it's difficult for us to make those distinctions because we can't get that detailed resolution. But in rats, there are lots of studies where you can lesion different parts of the amygdala, essentially knock it out, and see what effect it has. And so we can't say specifically which subnuclei is involved. We just know that the structure is involved.
But what would be the effect? Is one related to pain and the other related to isolation?
So they're not related to very different emotional states necessarily, but they're connected very differently to parts of the brain. Uh-huh. So for instance, the dorsal medial prefrontal cortex you mentioned, we know specifically what part of the amygdala connects to mm-hmm. that brain structure. And so we can implicate that part of the amygdala in that brain structure's behavior.
Can I ask a follow-up question? Does neuroscience allow us to sort of get some sense of the purity or strength of emotions? Because to the degree that we do talk about hate in this categorical, unconditional way, you don't say you hate something a little bit. The very word means there's nothing good about this. It's all bad. Can we get a neurological picture of how pure an emotion is?
We can get a nervous system picture that is probably para or sympathetic nervous system dependent. So we can use things like galvanic skin response and measure changes in your sweat glands. We can measure heart rate. We can measure other physiological signs that aren't the brain necessarily and get an idea of magnitude. That we can definitely do. But in the brain, we're not going to get the same magnitude picture because the way we figure out what parts of the brain are active doesn't allow us to do so because we depend on subtractions and contrasts, which aren't necessarily going to give us magnitude information. In the same way, looking at your heart rate, looking at your skin temperature, looking at your sweating, for instance, that's involved in GSR is going to give us.
You know, Joe, if you think about some of the things that Lasana has said, the relationship between scarcity, for instance, mm-hmm. and this kind of behavior, we easily identify hate crimes if we've used an epithet, if there's a whole – if you desecrate a synagogue deliberately, we understand what was at stake there. But now I'm thinking even in an economic crime, if you murder somebody to get their money, mm-hmm. I mean, is that some form of scarcity and isn't some version – do we have to recontextualize or redefine our understanding of hate now that we see – all that's involved, including the fear of scarcity, the fear of loss.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on how broadly you define hate. I mean, I think to kill someone for money, you have to literally reduce them to a non-human status, right, in order for that equation to work. I remember reading in the literature, interesting, one interview with a hitman. You know, you think, well, that's a paradigm case of economic murder. And what this guy said is that, and he was, you know, serving a life term, he didn't have any reason to be lying about his emotional or mental states. He reported that he used to have to work himself up into a rage to do a killing. And what he would do is he would relive past experiences of abuse or humiliation when he was a child just to create this sort of loop that Lasana is talking about, activate all those responses. He didn't talk about it in terms of loops or activating. He would just say, I'd relive all these terrible things that happened to me, get myself really angry, and then he would go kill someone who he didn't even know, just for money.
Well, that raises the question of what it takes to get people to do that, because Lasana, you talk about the out group being something as an offender. We can begin to work up hatred, but then to take the next step to kill. Even the military has recognized that people don't kill people, and one of the things they have to do is dehumanize the enemy so that these young men and young women can actually pull the trigger. Rhetoric would have a lot to do with that.
Yeah. In fact, for the text that I've been looking at, some of the things that are really common to those are really some issues we've raised here, right? That within the text, there are moves to inflate the in-group, you know, to let people know who may have problems, right, that they really come from kings, that they are really superior kinds of people. You know, a next step, you know, is to denigrate the out-group as inferior in stereotypical kinds of terms, very often dehumanizing and denigrating. A third step that takes us closer to violence, you know, is that the out-group is constructed and discussed as a specific threat to this really valued in-group. And finally, and this happens in a lot of different kinds of ways, there is a kind of rhetorical conquering of the out-group. And in these cases, authors of text ask readers to imagine the death of their enemy. You know, and in some of the internet texts that I've looked at, they set up games for people so that people playing the games literally have a killer's perspective as they work their way through a building, killing the enemies of their group.
Let's go back to the phones now. Mary's on the line from Martinsville, Virginia. Hello, Mary.
Yes. I'd like to know, is the programming on some radio talk shows, would that be considered related to hate speech?
Certainly not this show.
Oh, no. No, sir.
No, but we love your call. No, but thank you. Yeah, Michael?
Well, I'd say depending upon the show. You know, if it is not hate speech, it comes very closely to hate speech. It is a cousin in that it will possess some of the characteristics that I just described.
I would like to draw this follow up on this larger connection the caller is raising, though, which is, you know, look, this sort of hateful rhetoric, it drives only a small amount of probably violence, right? I mean, you've got people who have problems, disordered offenders, who they've got their antennas up and they'll pick up on things they hear. But they're people who are at risk of engaging in violent behavior to begin with. I think the larger problem with hate is this categorical, unconditional way of thinking, whereas they're all bad and we're all good. And you can look at the larger polarization in our politics and draw, you know, a very straight line. And ultimately, as terrible as these crimes of mass violence are, they're very small. And the effects are very small compared to the enormous problems we have because we have a very polarized political environment where government can't really achieve very much.
Yeah, thank you for your call, Mary. And it also gets back to what Lasana was saying about disgust, that sense that this is a contaminant. It is poison. It's toxin in our environment. We've got to get rid of it. It's not just an idea we don't like or people sharing ideas that we don't share. It's going to kill us. Mm-hmm. And it also gets to some of what happens on TV. I know, Joe, you've observed that hate talk on TV comes in different forms. I want to play this clip about it's a TV report on Nancy Grace. Let's listen.
29-year-old Toni Medrano died of her injuries Saturday after setting herself on fire. Medrano was accused of manslaughter after she allegedly fell asleep on her 3-week-old child and asphyxiated him. Now Medrano's family is accusing HLN's outspoken legal commentator, Nancy Grace, for contributing to the suicide. Here's a clip from Grace's June 11th show where she reports on Medrano's case.
Did mommy booze it up and kill her baby? My question is, why no murder one charges? But hold on. Let's start our experiment. Here you go. Here's one.
Grace went on to pour 9 more drinks, representing the alcohol Medrano had consumed prior to her son's death. Grace's 6-minute report labeled Medrano the vodka mom and sparked a wave of negative internet backlash against her. Medrano's family says the report had a deep psychological impact on an already troubled individual.
Joe Kennedy, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think a real problem is that we have shows, and it's obviously an appetite for these shows, which really engage in almost these ritual reenactments, which allow us to really just experience, feel, concentrate hatred, right? I mean, that's some of these shows, that's all it's about. It's let's all get together and let's just dwell on someone and something they did, and let's just hate them as much as we can. I just think, and it's clearly an appetite for that. I mean, everyone's free to do whatever programming they want, and clearly there's an audience for it, but I just don't think it's a very healthy thing.
Yeah, but let's talk about that audience and why that might be so. Lasana, is it I mean, clearly people do. It's a very popular show to watch that angry face on for however long it's on, call people angry names, and whip you up. Why do we like that? Is that adaptive?
Well, it has to do with anger. Anger is an interesting negative emotion. So most negative emotions are avoidance emotions. They make you want to get away. They make you want to get rid of the emotion. Anger is the opposite. Anger is an approach emotion. Anger draws you in. Anger wants you to sort of pay attention to it, wants you to feed into it, wants you to build it up. And so just the nature of that emotion, I think, is probably part of what attracts people to these shows as well. And so anger is a very dangerous emotion in that sense, in that it feeds on itself, it allows itself to keep going, whereas lots of other negative emotions like fear, for instance, or disgust, want you to get away from the thing that's causing you to have the emotion.
And that probably provides some insight. That Nancy show probably provides some insight, you know, into how we find pleasure. through hateful kinds of speech and the creation of us against them kinds of categorization, right? Perhaps, you know, if I'm a mom watching Nancy Grace's show, right, and I'm that person is getting constructed, I'm probably thinking to myself, that's not me. I'm different.
I only have 8 shots before I get the kids to bed. No, but so that's part of it. But Lasana, you were saying too that certainly that's part of it. This allows me a kind of virtue, you know, that I can't have if I don't watch people who are far, far more negligent than me. But also this wanting to be engaged, this false sense of being engaged through the anger, but really nothing is happening. There's nothing, no change taking
exactly
place.
And it's safe, right? It's safe for me to sit and look at that on television. I'm not the one involved. My kids aren't being affected by it. I'm just sort of participating. I'm sort of a observer participant. There's just this feature of negative emotion. So think about a car accident on the highway, for instance. Why is it that you have this traffic pileup around a car accident when the road has been cleared? It's because people are stopping and looking at this horrible thing. And so very negative things, very bad things seem to capture our attention and draw us in for good reasons evolutionarily, right? We want to know about bad things. And I think that's something that's gotten perverted, and that's why these shows are so popular. That's why people want to see these things.
There's also a basic narrative structure to these shows, and it's about scapegoating. The basic structure is evil is obvious, and it doesn't need to be understood. And they focus on the worst possible crimes. And so you don't need to understand background, history, anything. Just let yourself hate this person because this is obvious evil.
And it makes you feel better. We're talking about hate on the show today, why we do it, why we engage in it, and whether or not it has any long-term effects. On the state of things today, Michael Waltman at UNC, law professor Joe Kennedy is with us, Lasana Harris, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke. We'll take your phone calls when we come back in a minute. Stay with us, please. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Hatred seems like an irrational emotion, so much, though, that sometimes it's kind of funny.
I would like to thank God Almighty for giving everybody so much and me so little. I hate you. I hate you. I don't even know you, and I hate your guts. I hope all the bad things in life happen to you and nobody else but you.
That's comedian Dave Chappelle, who got a laugh out of the concept of hate. And I guess we're all guilty of using that word when we don't mean it, when we do mean it. And it expresses something about how we're feeling, that's for sure. But what do we mean? And is harboring hatred damaging? How much to us and to others? We're trying to understand hate on the show today. My guest, Joseph Kennedy, professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill. Michael Waltman is an associate professor of communication studies at UNC. Lasana Harris is an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke. And we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. So, Lasana, can this be is there a good hate? Does it help us at all? I mean, apart from maybe marking and recognizing bad things, you know, you want to avoid the thing that made the accident so it gets our attention. Is there anything that sort of happens to us biologically that makes us better, stronger, smarter?
Yeah, hate, if you think about it in this intergroup context, and Mike, you touched on this before, it really is good for the in-group. If we all hate the same thing, that strengthens our group. It allows us to make more self-sacrificing decisions. We're more likely to cooperate, to be pro-social within our group. And so in the political context, if I hate the other party, that's good for my party. That's good for us at our convention. We can rally around that hate, and we can do more positive things than we might have done otherwise. Biologically, we still know very little about it. I can say in terms of hate and anger, being angry isn't good for you. Health-wise, it sort of gets your threat system going, which it's not something that our bodies are designed to do constantly. So if you're always angry, if you're always sort of flying into a rage because you're always feeling hate, then that's probably taking years off your life. It's sort of putting you at risk for heart problems. It's putting you at risk for a number of other types of ailments. So biologically, it's not good. But in short, small doses, it's a very sort of beneficial emotion for the group.
Well, let me make my distinction. I'm going to make a distinction, and then you can have at it if you think however accurate it might be. But anger is a thing that seems to me it rises and falls. There's a proximate cause. Something happened. It made me angry. The thing has stopped happening. I'm not angry anymore. Hate might build in after that because you did it. I now hate you. And I'm going to continue to hate you long after the elbow or whatever has passed. This taking on a life of its own is the the problem with hate, isn't it? And it can re-trigger the anger, but the anger kind of rises and falls. Hate is it's a narrative, isn't it? It's a concept that's constructed and then takes on a life of its own in a way that this emotion is really triggered by something in our environment.
Yeah, that was actually, you know, a distinction that Aristotle made between anger and hatred, that hatred really is long-lasting. It sticks with us. And perhaps it's because we tend to find pleasure in hate at times. Perhaps it's because there are narratives that are kind of built into our minds that make it kind of stick. And I'm sorry, I forgot where I was going with that.
Well, that's fine. But we're just talking about whether the narratives take on a life of their own, and they're not real. Anything that we construct in our little heads, however precious those ideas might be, they're not on the ground.
Right.
They're just in our
right.
head.
Hate is an attitude. That's exactly right. It's not an emotion, right? It's different.
Yeah. I mean, even if you go with Lasana's sort of definition of hate, I mean, that seems to work well once you can clearly define the in-group and the out-group. The question is, in our world today, who do we want to be the out-group? I mean, can we afford to have anybody that we really hate?
Right.
Sort of like, well, you know, we hate this country, hate this group. You know, it's one world and it's getting smaller and smaller. Right. I guess on a more simple level, there's a line from a poem that's on a fridge magnet I have that I looked at this morning. It said, think often of your friends and seldom of your enemies. And just on a day-to-day basis in terms of being a happier, more healthy person, I would think people who think more of their friends and of their enemies are happier.
Well, if we construct hatred, we can certainly construct love or the thing that would be the antidote, it seems to me.
Right. And, I actually did a little work that kind of touched on this, that I sort of see hate speech as really speech dehumanizing, meant to destroy another's valued identity. So if we begin to think about how we can cultivate more humane communities through a kind of anti-hate speech, it seems to me that through a variety of actions and discourses, one of the things that we want to accomplish is for those people who have been harmed by hate speech is to rehumanize those identities.
Right. And just to touch on that, we do know a lot about dehumanization, both psychologically and biologically. That's actually one of the phenomena we understand quite well. So we're all capable of dehumanizing. It's not something that's reserved for special people.
Right.
And so in cases where you get hate speech that fires people up and makes it likely to dehumanize somebody else, that's a very effective tool. Right.
Right. Yeah. The other thing, of course, about hate, even if hate has some sort of cathartic effect, to the degree that it's bound up with scapegoating, it's diverting our attention as a society from the things we should be paying attention to. So we spend so much time obsessing about this woman with her 8 shots of vodka. We don't give any thought to the larger conditions in our society which allow something like that to sort of happen.
Well, that leads me to this thought that I had regarding last week's program. We had a former prosecutor on. There was in Des Moines, Iowa, a hate crime. Neo-Nazis desecrated a synagogue. There was an outpouring of outrage in Des Moines, really calling for the blood of these two neo-Nazis, very angry. And he decided this would be a test case for restorative justice. So he got the people at the synagogue to agree to sit down with the perpetrators and talk this over. And they came to a rich and deep understanding that may have seemed preposterous, talking to Holocaust survivors who told these two people what it meant to them and how terrified they were. Suddenly, when all of them became human,
exactly.
when a neo-Nazi becomes an abused child with a hearing disorder and a Jew becomes a Holocaust survivor who feels the same terror and fear that he felt as a young man, they rehumanized.
Yeah, that's what makes us human. It's very simple, actually. The thing that's special about human beings is our mental states, our experiences, our lives, our memories, our emotions, our thoughts, our feelings. If I make that readily available to you, suddenly I'm a human being to you. So dehumanization involves suppressing those ideas, suppressing thinking about what your mind is like, what your mental states are like, what your thoughts and feelings and emotions are like. And we can track the brain correlates that get engaged when you think about somebody else's mental state. And we can see in most people that it's very possible in the right conditions to turn those things off. Right? It's a very flexible process. And so having a conversation with someone, finding out about them, finding what their lived experience is like, is sufficient to humanize someone. And it turns out, and we're testing a lot of these ideas now, that it's something that can get us past prejudice responses, get us past hate. So it's not love technically, it's sort of understanding more so.
And can you, I think there, Ben, and maybe you can correct me on this, but when we're angry, the very parts of the brain that might engage in that empathic behavior and understanding are the things that shut down.
Exactly. Because when we're angry, and more so when we're morally disgusted and we feel contempt towards the other person. Contempt sort of switches those things off.
You know, it's just interesting. I think it would be interesting to take and compare how we counsel our children to deal with their emotions, compare that to our sort of public discourse, right? When we talk to our children, I'm sure if you look at some school program, they talk about, you know, if you get angry, you let the emotion pass. When you watch some of our TV, you get angry, let's just hang on and rebroadcast that emotion as many times as we can.
Beth is on the line from Atlanta. Our reach is extended. Hello, Beth.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually had a question for Dr. Harris that kind of dovetails on some of this. I'm wondering about the role that psychopathy plays in the people who engineer large-scale hate movements. Like, you know, genocides are actually really logistically complicated. And so, you know, especially talking about reconciliation and humanizing effects, you know, do there seem to be differences between the people that are the engineers of these large-scale complicated genocides and hate movements versus the people who are drawn into them?
Great question. Thanks, Beth.
Yeah, so we've started studying psychopaths a little bit. And psychopaths are very interesting people. If you ever met a psychopath, you would not know that guy is a psychopath. They would be very charming and very open and outgoing. And the reason is psychopaths see everyone as sort of a means to an end, right? They're constantly trying to manipulate people. And it turns out that's a particular context that can cause dehumanization. And so what we found in our research is that psychopaths dehumanize everyone relative to how we would view other people. And so by their very nature, that's what psychopaths do. Now, in cases of specific genocide, we haven't studied any of those people. It would be great if we could get our hands on Hitler's brain, for instance. But we'd probably see some of these psychopathic traits in that person, right? We'd see that the people that are thinking very carefully and planning these large-scale movements are actually displaying some of these traits because that's what psychopaths do. They're very smart, they're very intelligent, and they're capable of manipulating people and events for their own sort of purpose.
But then they can apply science. Maybe this is so the psychopath is the natural, right? This is what they do and how they act. And then they can employ people who understand this
exactly,
in a much more
the
cold
use of hate speech,
and rational
exactly.
way to stir it up, become effective and much more efficient. Robin is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Robin.
Hi. Hey, I had a question for you. I had read once, and I'm not really sure where, that hate, and particularly like the response that people feel when they're watching a radio program that is very hate-filled or, you know, TV program, that it has sort of a brain chemical response, like a adrenaline almost, and that you can become addicted to that feeling.
Wow.
And
well, let's get an answer.
I'm curious. Can I verify that? Like I said, I read that a while ago.
All right.
Well, and it sort of stuck with me.
Let's get an answer. Thanks, Robin.
So because of the approach nature of anger, for instance, it is something that you enjoy. You enjoy experiencing that emotion. Now, neurobiologically, it's a little unclear as to why. I can't pinpoint a specific chemical. It might be dopamine. It might be serotonin. The point is there is something engaging and approaching about that experience, definitely.
Is the internet the fact that people who felt isolated and maybe couldn't communicate with other like-minded people, now they can? You know, what impact, if any, is that having on all of this?
Well, you know, it's really hard to study hate speech without studying the internet. It's played a huge role. You know, there was a time when if people from hate groups wanted to get together, they might have to travel very long distances to a compound in Idaho. You know, now for the price of a cheap consumer, a modem and a router, you know, people can go online. They can they locate chat boards where they can express themselves. They can construct their own identities. They can be who they want to be. And that's generally something they can't be in the real world.
I wonder if it works. You know, we talked about this antidote. Once you begin to understand and you open yourself to the other person's dilemma and their situation, you change the way you feel. Rhetoric, we know, can stir up hate just by reading it. Is it as effective in promoting, let's call it, love?
That I don't know. You know, there is some evidence, and not that I'm aware of that's been studied, but programs produced by the Southern Poverty Law Center, where you know they produce documentaries, they produce and provide school and community resources, and what I would say is that those documentaries and those resources really are a form of communication geared towards rehumanizing identities and encouraging people to see one another as they see the self, right? To have that kind of empathy.
And Joe, you talked about the effect of just the difference between how we would teach or train our children and then what we're exposed to. Obviously, politics, very polarizing. It may not always qualify as hate speech, but certainly identifying yourself over and against the other. So is there a mixed message? Is the very act of politics, the very process of politics in America today, something that promotes hate in and of itself?
Well, I mean, it's always on a rhetorical level, it's always easier to tear something down than to build something up, right? It's always easier to criticize than to sort of construct. And so especially in the fast soundbite world of sort of modern cable news journalism and on the internet, it's easier to say something snide and critical and derogatory than it is to sort of articulate some sort of compelling vision. You know, there's a lot of people in society saying people want a compelling positive vision. But, you know, until people start sort of acting on that belief, we're going to be stuck with the rhetoric that we have.
Well, neurologically, is love, is this feeling of communion, common being, the kind of weak force? It's not as powerful. It's not as compelling. Or does it work as powerfully on the brain as fear and anger?
It is very powerful. It is very compelling. And they're very related. They're sort of two sides of the same coin, right? I just think, as you said, people haven't chosen to go that route in the public, in the political sphere.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about, you know, and to some degree, hate's almost something like you can become addicted to. Well, I've been waiting for sort of the hangover to kick in, right? I'm waiting for the point we get where it's like, you know, you've been on this, where as a society, we've been on this sort of anger, emotional sort of jag for some period of time. And all of a sudden, we wake up one day and it's like, you know, this isn't getting me anywhere in my life. Let me try something different.
Well, but that's the nature of scapegoating, to say that whatever my discomfort, whatever my pain, yeah, I got a hangover. We still have this problem because the problem is the X people, and they're
right.
Still here.
Yeah.
That's why I have a headache. That's why I have these heart palpitations. It's their fault.
But, you know, a lot of addicts age out somewhere in their middle age. They go from one jag to another, and then they burn out. And hopefully we'll burn out on hate at some point, burn out on polarized rhetoric.
I think so. So it's not – but it's compelling, you say, that this antidote, this other feeling. But clearly if it was the easier of the two, if it were the more effective, we'd be talking love, not hate, and that's how politicians get elected.
Yeah, but it's the context as well. Like you said, it's the political system. It's the fact that it's this adversarial system that's always going to drive it. So let's think about another very famous neurochemical, oxytocin, right? We've all heard about it. It's supposed to be the love drug. Well, we've recently discovered that oxytocin doesn't just engender love and feelings of affiliation, but in a competitive context, it makes you more aggressive and more competitive, right? And so until the context has changed, until that paradigm no longer exists, where there's an adversarial system, for me, it's difficult to see us burning out in hatred.
All right. Well, I have to leave it right there. I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Lasana Harris, Assistant Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke. Michael Waldman is an Associate Professor in the Department of Communication Studies and the author of The Communication of Hate, Language as Social Action. Joseph Kennedy is a Professor of Law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank all of you for being on the show.
Thank
Great
you.
To have you.
Thank you, Frank.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can go to our website, stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.